Welcome to Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio with author, speaker, and your host, Pat Rulo, serving you a generous helping of everything you need to know to help you and your loved ones stay safe during any doctor or hospital visit. The program is not intended to replace medical advice from a licensed professional, but rather to encourage you to become a well-informed participant in your health and well-being. And now, your host, Pat Rulo.
Hello and welcome. I'm Pat Rulo, your hostess and the voice for patient safety. I'm so glad you're joining me today, and I hope your week was a happy one. I'm still recuperating, well, I guess you'd call it that, since my mom passed away recently. It's strange that I still find myself in the old routine, making a big Sunday dinner, even though she's not here, heading for the phone every night around 7 o'clock to call her to check in. And someone sent me flowers last week to share their condolences, and my first reaction was, oh, wait until I tell Mom that Cindy and Larry sent flowers. Only to catch myself and return to reality. Kind of crazy, right? Oh well, we had lots of fun together, and all of her doctor and hospital visits were great topics for this show. But then I'm never really at a loss for what to talk about. And this week was no different. So, with that, let's head into what crossed my path a few days ago, because right now, it's time for the health hazard of the week.
Cell phone.
Last week, I posted a hot-off-the-press article on Facebook about the dangers of allowing young children access to cell phones. Actually, it was a warning, albeit a weak one, from the American Academy of Pediatrics. And we received some thumbs up for the post, but one gal in particular thought she'd like to call me out on it, saying she interviewed a doctor, and the doctor said basically, not to worry. Well, now, I don't usually respond to nonsense on social media, but this one irritated me. She spoke to a doctor. Well, right now, I could head over to the closest hospital and stop every doctor in the hallway and ask them about the health dangers of cell phone radiation, and I guarantee you, the vast majority would either have no idea what I was talking about or suggest that I don't worry about it. Why? Because most people, doctors or not, are either happily uninformed or willingly uninformed. I mean, who wants to stop chasing Pokemans around town or texting silly emojis? No one wants to give up their toys. So her argument of having asked a doctor did nothing to help her case. I've personally spent the last 3 years or so studying and researching the topic and interviewing some of the top scientists in the world in order to get a real handle on the situation. Now, just like most people, I enjoy the convenience offered by a smartphone. I don't really want to know what I now know about the health ramifications. But it seems to me the science supersedes industry. Science trumps what you hear, or should I say, what you don't hear from our government. When I can watch a video of human DNA break in two after cell phone exposure, I don't need to see any more. When I can watch blood under a microscope rapidly clump together after exposure to radio frequencies, I don't need to see any more. And I certainly don't have to ask a local doctor what he or she thinks about it. One of the contributing authors to the Bioinitiative Report, a gentleman whom I've also personally interviewed and shared on this program before, Dr. Martin Blank. He's a scientist, a lecturer, and a retired professor from Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons with a PhD in physical chemistry. He has investigated the cellular and biological effects of electromagnetic frequencies. In a recent interview, he was asked, what does the science say in terms of the impact these frequencies have on our health? And notice I'm saying, what does the science say? Not what does industry say, or not what does the government say, but what does the science say? And he replied, back in 1995, a published paper showed that if you took DNA and subjected it to radiation, the 60 hertz stuff, you get fragments coming off. You are breaking off parts of the molecule, damage that is not repairable. When you break a piece of DNA, you've broken the code. It's not like when you get a cut and the skin heals. If you damage the DNA, that's called a mutation, and you affect the function of a cell. So depending on where the damage has occurred, you can cause a lot of problems. He continues, there is no question in my mind that children are far more vulnerable. This is accepted by people who understand how this radiation works and understand the difference between children and adults. Biologically, when we compare an adult and a child, the child has a thinner cranium bone and the nerves in their brain are not as fully myelinated. This means the child will get more penetration as a result of the same kind of exposure. And of course, another thing about a child is that they're still growing, so whatever damage is done is going to propagate. So the question, why aren't there stronger warnings against this exposure, especially for children? Dr. Blank replies, the industry has lobbied very expensively. We don't live in an ideal system. You can buy opinions. If you pay off the right people, you can get the results that you want. I'm not being cynical, he said. I'm just saying it the way it is. The people who are testifying on behalf of industry are consultants for industry, or they have contracts from industry, but they also have scientific credentials. When asked, what recommendations would you make to people who wish to protect themselves from these fields? He says, I think the introduction of Wi-Fis in school is sinful. It's criminal. Good education doesn't need this. There are ways to bring these programs in without this technology. Generations have actually learned better without this. There's absolutely no need to have children sit there with this exposure for how many hours they keep it on. They could bring in the programs by cables or books, but they don't need Wi-Fi. I think children are going to succumb to this in larger numbers, and we're going to see higher incidence among children of things like brain cancer. So this is coming from someone who knows what he's talking about and is not tied to industry. Now, an argument is sometimes posed to those who express concern about radiation from smart meters, Wi-Fi, and so on, that the radiation emitted from these devices is such a low level that the public doesn't need to worry about it. However, this is not necessarily accurate. In fact, studies have showed the opening of the blood-brain barrier from even very low levels of radiation exposure. Two scientists whom I interviewed and shared with you last year, Cindy Sage and Dr. David Carpenter, explained in 2008 in a paper published in the peer-reviewed journal Pathophysiology entitled The Public Health Implications of Wireless Technologies that it is actually the weakest exposure level that showed the greatest effect in opening up the blood-brain barrier. And in fact, I have Cindy Sage here today as a guest later in the program. Now, in May of 2011, the World Health Organization officially recognized that wireless radiation, such as emitted by smart meters, is a possible carcinogen, meaning that it can cause cancer. For those who may have missed some of my previous programs about the health effects from smart meters are digital utility meters that send the customer's detailed usage information to the utility company using a radio frequency transmitter or over the power lines in the case of a power line carrier system. Some meters, the AMI mesh networks, also contain other capabilities such as a remote shutoff. Smart meters are part of a larger plan to change the electricity grid to a smart grid, although there is controversy about whether the customer meter is actually crucial to that change. Electric smart meters are replacing older analog style meters, while gas smart meters are generally small devices attached to the existing gas meter. Wireless water meters are also being installed in many regions. So how can you tell if you have a smart meter? Well, go outside and have a look. The non-transmitting analog, the mechanical electric meter, the safe ones, typically have five small clock-like dials and a glass casing which allows you to see the spinning dial inside. Smart meters have digital displays and plastic casings which you cannot see into. And recent smart meters often have the word smart on the front, but absence of this label is not a guarantee that it is not transmitting. And these meters can only be identified sometimes by measuring the RF emission, the radio frequency emissions. after decades of corporately funded, biased research being held up as the industry standard, there are now hundreds of independent, peer-reviewed scientific studies showing there is a clear health hazard with technology that emits wireless radiation in the range that smart meters do. And meanwhile, tens of thousands of people with a smart meter installed in their homes have contracted illnesses, insomnia, rashes, headaches, and worse. Many have been forced to leave their homes entirely due to the adverse effects of radiation. What's more, in apartment buildings where 30 plus or more smart meters are installed in a single electrical room, the dangers are even higher. So here are some common questions we get regarding smart meters. Question: can I measure radiation from a smart meter myself? The answer is yes. You can purchase a meter for a relatively low cost and learn how to read it yourself. There are several consumer devices on the market that measure the radiation that smart meters emit. For most people, I personally recommend the Cornet meter, and I have that available for purchase on our website, speakupandstayalive.com. And that includes a free copy of my book, because I really want folks to have one of these meters. Now, one of the issues with smart meters is that they have extremely short spikes of RF, usually just 2 to 3 milliseconds. So while your utility company would have this sound harmless, it seems clear from the number of health complaints that the human nervous system has no trouble registering a signal that is that brief. Most electric smart meters are in the 800 to 1000 megahertz range of the radio frequency microwave band. Gas meters can be in the 4 to 500 megahertz range, and the Cornet meter available at our website does in fact measure from 100 megahertz all the way up to 8 gigahertz. So it can get the job done for you. Another question: can I shield my living space from the RF radiation from my smart meter? And the answer is, it is possible to shield against smart meter radiation, but in order to assess the results, you really do need a meter so you know if you are actually solving the problem or making it worse. Now, the idea of shielding is to place an RF barrier between you and the source of the RF. And there are several materials that actually block RF radiation. One is aluminum foil, especially the heavy-duty type, in two layers overlapping can block a good deal of RF, and you want to put the shiny side toward the source of the RF. You can also get aluminum mesh screening from a hardware store that can effectively shield RF as well. And on our website, it actually takes you to another site called Safe Living Technology from Canada, and they offer some of these shielding devices. But again, you can find that at our website at the link that says EMF Safety. At the speakupandstayalive.com website. Now, remember though, shielding can produce unwanted or unexpected problems. Shielding without being able to measure the resulting effectiveness is not recommended. And shielding in the presence of multiple sources of RF is also not recommended, because a shield against one source can act to reflect and intensify the RF from another source. So if you have a smart meter and you're concerned about this and you're going to do some shielding, first, disconnect all other wireless devices in your home, Wi-Fi, cordless phones, disconnect microwaves, fluorescent light bulbs, and so on. And so then if there's absolutely no way to have your smart meter removed, shield it with care and place close attention to how the change makes you feel. And you actually get help doing it, because if you're sensitive, you do not want to be standing directly in front of the meter for any period of time. Then you're going to want to buy an RF meter to measure the radiation in your environment so you can shield in the right places and measure the results. So as I said, make sure other sources of RF in your environment are removed or relocated, such as cordless phones and Wi-Fi. And you always want to ground your shielding to a ground, and you may need to ask an electrician for help. Now, I don't recommend wrapping the meter in foil, again, as this may cause the meter to increase power to the transmitter as it attempts to connect repeatedly. But you'd know that if you had one of the handheld meters. Now, any type of smart meter shielding is never a replacement for actually getting an analog meter reinstalled. Shielding doesn't do anything to reduce dirty electricity, the privacy violations, the fire risks, or the other documented smart meter problems. But say for travel or temporary purposes, or an area where there's no possibility of getting an analog replaced, Some of these products may be useful to reduce the RF exposure. Another question, can I shield the RF from my gas meter? Gas meters are often freestanding, and therefore it could be easier to cut the emissions from the smart meter module on your gas meter. I've heard from a Southern California utility customer who shielded her gas meter so as to cut the RF going into her house but not cut it off from communicating to the network. She measured the RF before and after and says the amount entering her home from the gas meter was greatly reduced. She used a flexible metal screening mesh from a big box store and a stapler and wrapped the meter and stapled it in place and then cut an opening in the side furthest from her house in order to let the signal out so it could go back to the utility company. And she said this appears to direct the RF away from her home. Now, again, I can't assure you those results nor the safety of this arrangement, but a meter would help you. A handheld meter would help you know at least what's going on. And as I alluded to earlier, the best thing to do is not to have one installed at all. But most of us are not so lucky. So if you find that you unknowingly have one, make a call. Or better yet, write a letter via certified mail to your utility. And you'll find that number on your bill. And tell them you demand an analog meter. Ask to speak to someone in management. If you have been made ill by your smart meter, tell them about that in detail. Tell them you know of the people who have gotten analogs. Tell them you're going to go to the press if they don't do the same thing for you that they've done for others. And do not accept a digital, what they say, non-transmitting meter, because they also have problems and are not stable and secure like analog meters. So please don't take no for an answer. Ask to speak to someone higher up and do not give up. And if you'd like more information, visit this website. It's called stopsmartmeters.org. They have a whole lot more information than I do. stopsmartmeters.org. stopsmartmeters.org. And while we're at it, let me mention microwave ovens once again. Have you ever wondered why food is often unevenly heated when you remove it from the microwave? This happens because microwaves work with whatever water molecules are present. And since not all areas of food contain the same amount of water, heating becomes uneven. Microwave ovens pulse electromagnetic waves through food, exciting the molecules and causing them to move, vibrate, and heat up as they respond to the microwave radiation. A Swiss study led by the biologist and food scientist Dr. Hans Hertel identified the effects of microwave food. For 8 weeks, 8 people lived in a controlled environment and intermittently ate raw foods, conventionally cooked foods, and microwave foods. And blood samples were tested after each meal. The microwave food caused significant changes in blood chemistry. Similar to what I was talking to you about earlier, where the blood was clotting under the microscope. Studies have found eating food processed from a microwave oven can cause permanent brain damage by shorting out electrical impulses in the brain. Studies have found the prolonged eating of microwave foods cause cancerous cells to increase in human blood. Minerals, vitamins, and nutrients of all microwave food is reduced or altered so that the human body gets little or no benefit. Microwave foods cause stomach cancer and intestinal cancerous growths and tumors. This may explain the rapid increase rate of colon cancer in America. Continual ingestion of microwave foods causes immune system deficiencies through lymph gland and serum alterations. Eating microwave foods causes loss of memory, concentration, emotional instability, and a decrease of intelligence. That can account for some of the encounters I've had recently. Microwaving milk and cereal grains converted some of their amino acids into carcinogens, into cancer-causing agents. Thawing frozen fruits converted their glucoside into carcinogenic substances. Extremely short exposure of raw, cooked, or frozen vegetables converted their plant alkaloids into carcinogens. So in summary, it's more and more apparent that microwaves and microwave cause cancer and other malicious diseases. I mean, they have the power to destroy the goodness in our food and weaken our bodies. And we all should be thinking about permanently getting rid of them. I know I have. I mean, it's really not that difficult to heat your food conventionally. So why in the world would you risk your health in an effort to save 2 minutes of your time, when in reality, you are seriously shaving time off of your life and risking a potential disease like cancer by using the microwave. I mean, that just doesn't make sense, does it? So all of this conversation today because someone disputed my Facebook post. Now, sadly, this is not a matter of opinion. Asking a random doctor is not proof of anything. I mean, just because someone is a doctor of feet or eyes by no means suggests that he or she is the go-to resource on the complexities of wireless radiation. So bottom line, be safe, be smart. Do everything you can to shield yourself, your family, and your home from the damaging health effects of cell phones, wireless routers, cordless phones, microwave ovens, and smart meters. And the only way to make the invisible visible is with a handheld meter. And you can find them at our website, speakupandstayalive.com. Just visit the link that says EMF safety. And once you own a detection meter, you can now measure the levels of radiation emitted, not only from your or your neighbor's smart meter, but also from cell towers in your neighborhood, stealth, cell antennas, hidden within flagpoles, in church steeples, gas station signs, wireless in libraries, stores, coffee shops, hotels, hospitals, and from cell phones and secondhand phone. So why do I talk about this on a patient safety program? Because my primary goal is to keep you out of the hospital. And that starts when you take care of yourself at home. So please take to heart what I'm telling you today. This topic is not a matter of believing. Some people say, oh, I don't believe this is true. Why would they sell anything that could be so dangerous? To which I reply, this is not a religion. It's not a belief system. It's science and facts being suppressed because if you really did know the truth, the industry would be out of business. It's a simple case of follow the money. So hear me now or hear me later. Eventually, you will be saying, oh, Pat was spot on. Just take the necessary precautions before it's too late. Visit the link that says EMF safety at the speakupandstayalive.com website. Spend $190 and get yourself a meter. It is the best insurance policy you will ever own. Or you can call me 440-725-5462. And please, this week, work on it. Unplug your microwave and practice safe phone.
What's the nerve of you talking on your cell phone? Ain't you got nothing better to do talking on your cell phone? Walking down the sidewalk, sitting at home with your girlfriend, knowing I wish you'd put it away, that itty bitty cell phone. Drive your SUV, talking on your cell phone. Miracle of technology, dispatching cell phone. You walking around like it's glued to your ear with a ha-ha, hee-hee. A new drug with a battery, a cell phone. In the movie we hear it ring, your fancy little cell phone. In the restaurant, hear it sing, that trendy cell phone. Dum, 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 dum. Trade your stocks and buy a new car, you're so important. Nothing really matters but your cell phone. Cell phone, cell phone. We hear everything you said while talking on your cell phone. Dum. I wanna beat you over the head with your stupid ugly cell phone. Dum, 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 you're talking, neck and talking, neck and talking, neck and talking, neck and talk, talk.
What?
Yak, yak. Cell phone, cell phone, cell phone, cell phone, cell phone, cell phone.
I'm here with disturbing news about our favorite gadgets, cell phones, tablets, Wi-Fi, etc. Putting it bluntly, they are damaging the living cells in our bodies and killing many of us prematurely. I'm Dr. Martin Blank from the Department of Physiology and Cellular Biophysics at Columbia University. Before Edison's light bulb, there was very little electromagnetic radiation in our environment. The levels today are very many times higher than natural background levels and are growing rapidly because of all the new devices that emit this radiation. An example that a lot of us have in our pockets right now is the cell phone. One study shows that as cell phone usage has spread widely, the incidence of fatal brain cancer in younger people has more than tripled. We are putting cellular antennas on residential buildings and on top of hospitals where people are trying to get well. Wireless utility meters and cell towers are blanketing our neighborhoods with radiation. Future generations, our children, are at risk. The World Health Organization and international standard-setting bodies are not acting to protect the public's health and well-being. We are really all part of a large biological experiment without our informed consent. To protect our children, ourselves, and our ecosystem, we must reduce exposure by establishing more protective guidelines.
After the show, be sure to visit the website speakupandstayalive.com for more life-saving information. Plus, that's where you can purchase the book, Speak Up and Stay Alive, The Patient Advocate, Hospital Survival Guide. Bring the book to the hospital with you. It's the best way to stand out and in a positive way. And remember, we donate 2 handmade pillowcases to a local veteran's shelter for every book sold with your name on it as the donor. So for a mere $20, you benefit, and so does some well-deserving warrior. Give a meaningful and useful gift that really says, I care. Give the gift of healthcare safety. Purchase the book, the patient safety logs, and throw in some of those icebreaker cards. It's a one-size-fits-all present that everybody needs. You can order online at speakupandstayalive.com or call me 440-725-5462. You are listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive, Patient Safety Radio. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo, always bringing you the most brilliant guests in the world when it comes to healthcare safety. And today's guest is quite special, and the topic is not a commonly discussed healthcare or hospital issue. And I'm talking about the negative health effects being driven by hospitals, a supposed place of healing, and their blind acceptance and use of electromagnetic fields, microwave frequencies emitted by wireless technology. Our guest today is Cindy Sage, the co-editor and principal author of the Bioinitiative Reports, both in 2007 and 2012, and a founder of the International Bioinitiative Working Group. For those who may not recall, the Bioinitiative Report is the report on the relationship between the electromagnetic fields associated with power lines and wireless devices and health, and is available on our website, speakupandstayalive.com, and I really encourage you to become familiar with the findings. Cindy's specialty area of practice is the science and public health effects of electromagnetic fields and radio frequency radiation. Her full bio is also posted on her website along with the Bioinitiative Report. Well, I am so pleased and honored to have this conversation today, so welcome to our show, Cindy.
Pat, it's really my pleasure, and thank you for having me.
You are welcome. Well, Cindy, as soon as you agreed to be on the show, we sent an email blast to our listeners and our followers asking them to send us their most pressing questions regarding EMF safety as it relates to healthcare and hospital stays. So with your permission, I'd like to format our time together by sharing some of those listeners' questions with you.
It's fine with me, and Pat, I want your listeners to know that I actually prepared an outline of talking points and things that I thought we could cover. But this morning when I saw the questions, I realized they were so excellent, I'd much rather answer questions, you know, than make a presentation. But what I'd like for people to know is that in response to these questions, there's really a lot of reference material and good, solid scientific and public health backup, which we want them to have confidence that these answers that they're going to get are really based in a lot of research.
Thank you for that. All right. Well, now, first, before we get into the questions, for those who may be finding us for the first time or for those who aren't so familiar with electromagnetic fields and microwave frequencies, can you give us a quick lesson? What are they and why are they hazardous to our health?
There are several kinds of electromagnetic fields. The EMF term is sort of the broad umbrella term. Within that, we have the power frequency fields, 50 and 60 hertz, that come from all things electric. They're the electric fields and magnetic fields that come from things that have motors, things that are wired, things that use electricity. And there are lots of those in hospitals that we want to talk about. They take a certain kind of a meter to measure, and they're a standalone piece of our conversation. The other part of our conversation is about radio frequency, microwave signals that are basically the product of all these new wireless technologies. People know them, you know, from cell phones and cordless phones, but in a hospital or healthcare setting, they're becoming, I mean, we are now seeing the mass deployment of radio frequency wireless gadgets and monitors and sensors of every kind. And both of these exposures are today listed as possible human carcinogens. This is a formal World Health Organization IARC listing. So there's a great collision coming between this sort of premature rollout of wireless technologies, particularly in healthcare settings, and the health effects they cause. So we need to talk about this and whether or not we have informed consent about it and whether people know about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's why I appreciate your being here. And I'm going to start out our conversation with my own observation slash question. I just drove to Colorado and back for the birth of my granddaughter, and I have radiation measuring meters with me, and I brought them to the hospital during my daughter's labor, and the numbers were registering in the extreme danger zone, and so I decided to look around and see what might be causing this, and initially, getting out of the car, I spotted cell towers or the cellular repeaters on top of the hospital building. So now, basically, everyone in the hospital, patients, staff, visitors, we're being exposed to extremely high levels of radiation. So my question is this: why are hospitals allowing cell towers or these cellular repeaters to be installed on the top of their buildings?
Well, Pat, I've had the same experience in hospitals that I've visited, and we've also done consulting in some hospitals for electromagnetic interference. So it's common to see. Now, the rollout of these and, you know, the hospitals leasing, you know, space to cell carriers really started around in the early 2000s, and by 2006 or 2007, they were everywhere. I think this probably in part predates widespread knowledge about the potential for health effects. So that's a part, but it certainly doesn't explain or justify the continued leasing of these sites because they're a conflict to healthcare. Being under them probably is less bad than being in a building adjacent to where they're mounted on a roof. So that's one point of view, and I think probably you were measuring, oh my gosh, there are so many sources now, including, you know, on these mothers in labor and delivery, they're wearing wearable, you know, devices that transmit radio frequency to monitor labor in many cases. So trying to parse, you know, apart all of the different sources of wireless might have been difficult in that setting. Nevertheless, what you are seeing defines the problem. We shouldn't be putting patients, nor should we be putting healthcare workers in these exposures because they're excessive.
Right. It was a frightening.
And congratulations on the birth of your first.
Thank you. And this next question kind of speaks also, because I had the same experience as well. It's from a gal, Mandy, in Phoenix. She said, my son and daughter-in-law just had a baby, and the hospital insisted on attaching an RFID tag, that's the radio frequency ID tag, to her little leg. The reason, in case of a kidnapping, is the medical risk worth the minuscule odds of someone snatching the child and running? In other words, are these RFID frequencies safe?
Well, I think that this is just a really bad choice for a very remote possibility for a child. If you look at one hospital, it's really quite good in California, where I was able to look at the RF emissions from these RFID tags. The child wears one, the mother wears one, and there's one on nurses, and then there's a sensor somewhere, you know, on that floor. And the range of these RFID, and these are radio frequency identification tags, RFID stands for that. They have a range of 30 to 50 feet to the RFID reader that's on that floor. Now, that tells me that as a system is logging all activities of the child with the RFID tag at 30 to 50 feet distance, that's too strong an emitter to be on a child, certainly in the unaided. And really not warranted in this case. I mean, there just isn't enough risk, and people should be paying attention. And there are many other ways of looking toward prevention of that problem. So RFID tags have no place on neonates.
Right. I mean, just because we have the ability to do something doesn't mean that we have to do it.
That's so right. And I think, you know, as a basic concept for everyone listening, you have to think about the layering up of radio frequency.
Yes.
The number of ways in which wireless is being introduced into medical technology, telemetry, surveillance monitoring, and then even at the checkout, you know, all of the patient electronic recordings, all of these things are new, and they are additive. So the actual cumulative exposure is enormous. So we have an enormous disconnect. We have a mass rollout of unnecessary and risky technology and absolutely no informed consent.
Right. And this is going to translate as well to homes and the wireless baby monitors. I just want to throw that out there as well. If they're dangerous in the hospital, they're dangerous at the home as well.
Yeah, they're dangerous. Baby monitors, electronic baby monitors, are so strong an RF signal. They should never be placed in a crib or in the room of a child. They really shouldn't be used.
But right.
You know, the other issue with that, of course, is that there have been many, you know, high-profile examples recently of hackers actually hacking into the wireless systems, you know, within homes that are maintained wirelessly, where a child can be seen. A child can be seen in a crib, and there can be two-way communication. And people who want to rob a home or simply terrorize a child can do so. So we believe that the ability to hack these systems is also a real concern.
I agree. All right. Mike from Ohio sent this. He said, Pat, I've heard that the frequencies given off my wireless devices contribute to fertility and reproductive problems. Please ask your guest about this.
Mike from Ohio is correct. The evidence is just snowballing. I would first say, look at the Chapter 18 in the 2012 Bioinitiative Report, which is a very extensive review, particularly for male fertility, for sperm quality, for sperm motility, sperm viability. It turns out that a man who is wearing a cell phone on his belt, even on standby, is likely to be creating health impacts to sperm that are irreversible and lead to mutations that may in fact be one of the factors we should be looking at for, you know, this epidemic rise in autism and ADHD. Being subjected to these spikes in radio frequency as the cell is trying to communicate to, you know, stay in touch with the nearest cell tower appears to be enough to damage sperm DNA. And the sperm has no DNA repair capacity, unlike, I think, every other cell of the body. So once damaged, they're damaged. So it's a great concern for men and fertility. And obviously, the prevention here is to think about turning your cell phone off, completely off. Don't put it on a belt for long periods. Don't carry it in your pocket. Don't carry it on your body. Take it out and use it when you want to check in. And if you have to have it on, put it 3 or 4 or 5 feet away from you on a desk or the seat of your car. It's a great concern. Now, there's another facet to this. And we have to consider men and women, and then we have to consider the developing fetus. Because the mother who uses a cell phone during pregnancy, in some public studies, we're seeing both in animal studies and human studies that in utero exposure for the fetus can lead to altered fetal brain development. And the way that that's exhibited is that by the time that child is in elementary school, they have more problems with learning and behavior. We are seeing the effects of cell phone radiation during pregnancy altering fetal brain development in mice and in human children, in the fetus, leading to problems later on. So we really don't want women to be using wireless or exposing themselves to wireless during pregnancy or pre-pregnancy.
Excellent advice. I would say the precautionary principle is warranted here. All right. Let's move on. A nurse in Boston emailed this one. RFID tags and chips are becoming a way of life in the hospital setting. They are used to keep track of equipment, sponges used during surgery. They can locate the immediate whereabouts of doctors during an emergency. It gives easy access to a patient's medical records through his or her RFID tag, can track patients as they move about the hospital, as well as limit the hospital's liability. Does Cindy think the benefits outweigh the health risks?
No, I don't think the benefits outweigh the health risks, because I don't think any of these people, I don't think hospital administrators nor their boards are doing any due diligence on the health risks of wireless. When there's another option than wireless, they should take it.
Right.
They shouldn't continue layering up. And this is not reducing their liability. It may be short-term, but certainly not when people figure out that this is a cause of cancers, neurological diseases, impairment of immune systems, and a very long list of long-term health consequences, and probably worse, the short-term effects on memory, cognition, concentration, focus of the healthcare workers is reducing their ability to do their job.
Yes.
They're endangering patient health and welfare and healing and treatment by being so groggy that this is a very stressful environment, mentally and physiologically. And to keep adding layers of electromagnetic field and radio frequency radiation that is unnecessary is counter in the most basic way to the charge to do no harm, because people can't keep track of patients or assets, sponges, things that go missing. They can't keep track of schedules as well, because their mental function is diminished and impaired by chronic exposure to very low levels of wireless. And these hospital environments for wireless are reaching much higher levels throughout. They are saturated with wireless radio frequency exposure. that we know today are related to the problems of cognition and memory, right, concentration.
Yeah. It's true. I've been to so many hospital seminars and been speaking at hospitals lately, and everything, every breakout session surrounds about the use of wireless technology. Rounding with iPads is all exciting, and it's so counterproductive to what we're supposed to be doing in a hospital, and that's healing people. And it's not just the patients, as you mentioned, that are at risk. Now your healthcare staff is at extreme risk of even keeping you safe. So,
yeah. And, you know, again, when you draw back, Pat, and you think, well, why are we in this situation? This mass rollout or deployment of wireless has been driven largely by companies that see a spin-off kind of gizmo or gadget that sounds good, but for their health effects. And they're being funded and they're being commercialized so fast we can hardly keep track of them. And because they can legitimately say, well, we comply with FCC standards, and they, you know, inevitably they do comply. They're legal. They're just harmful. And until we have new biologically based standards that relate to where people begin to get sick or they can't think straight, then we have no break on the deployment other than by complaining or rejecting, you know, treatment and treatment environments that are so rich in RF.
And that's kind of a frightening answer. A couple voices here and there is not going to make the difference, you know.
Yeah. So I think we have a lot of patient education to do, as well as, you know, medical hospital administrators, hospital board education to do in this.
Well, hopefully conversations like this will help bring it out, at least to the patient side, and maybe then they can refuse some of these things. Well, we could go on and on here. Can you tell us where we can learn more about you and what you do?
Our work at www.bioinitiative.org is the really important central repository for all of the science in public health. And it's written both for the layperson in the beginning, and then all the technical, you know, the hard science stuff is all in the back. It is where we want you to go to understand these issues.
And it's just a pleasure to have you with us today. I really, really appreciate your taking the time.
I want to thank you very much for putting some light on a really important topic.
Well, folks, this is a game-changing topic that no one in the media is really exposing. But when it does hit the fan, and it will, when people start getting sick and connecting the dots, remember, you heard about it here on Speak Up and Stay Alive, Patient Safety Radio. It's time for prudent avoidance. It's time to spread the awareness, and I'm counting on you to help. So stay with me. As usual, there's more to come. You're listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive, Patient Safety Radio, and I am your hostess, Pat Rullo, also author of the book, Speak Up and Stay Alive, The Patient Advocate Hospital Survival Guide, which will keep you safe during every healthcare or hospital encounter. And you can find that at the website, speakupandstayalive.com, or you can call me and order by phone. It's only $20, plus a few bucks for shipping, 440-725-5462. Well, we've had some pretty heavy conversations today, so let's lighten the mood a little bit. You know that each week I've been introducing you to my new line of essential oils called Tiny Drops, which you can find at the website tinydropseo.com, and the EO stands for essential oils. Somebody else had grabbed Tiny Drops. Who knows what they're selling? So the website address is tinydropseo.com. So many people bought essential oils this last week, and several folks have asked me very specifically, Pat, how shall I use these? So let me answer that question. Essential oils are generally used in four ways. First is aromatically, next is topically, the third is internally, and the fourth is externally. So let me give you a brief rundown of all four of those. Aromatically, the aromatic application is the most widely known and used. Essential oils are processed by the olfactory bulb and the limbic system, the same system that processes our thoughts, memories, and emotions, which can help us feel calm, encouraged, and stress-free. And the positive compounds and their properties, once within our bloodstream, can encourage our immune system response or promote well-being in many ways. This is because the aroma you breathe in is actually a fine mist or a vapor of the oil containing all the same properties of the oil itself. So here are some ways that you can use essential oils with an aromatic application. With a diffuser. A diffuser is just a little container that usually has water in it. Sometimes they plug in and you just put a couple drops in the diffuser. Now, a good diffuser should use cool or room temperature air or ultrasonic vibrations to diffuse the oil into the air, which help the oil molecules remain airbound for several hours or more and do not affect the structure of the oil through heat, which can diminish the quality of the oil. The next and my favorite way is direct inhalation. Directly inhaling the oil can be done by holding the bottle of essential oil a few inches from your nose and breathing in the aroma, or adding a drop or two to your hands and cupping them over the mouth and nose. And this is especially fun to do in the shower because it's nice and warm and the water creates a mist, and you just put a drop or two in your hands, cup your hands over your face while the shower water is hitting you, and it's very, very nice. Then there's indirect inhalation. You can add a drop to a handkerchief. Who uses handkerchiefs anymore? Anyway, a cotton ball, a small square of fabric, your shirt collar to your hair, a pillowcase. Try this with lavender to encourage a calming effect just prior to sleep. I always put a couple drops right on my pillowcase. It's very cool. Then there's the hot water vapor steam tent. Heat a pot of water. Don't boil it, but just heat it. Add 1 to 3 drops of essential oil. Place a towel over your head while leaning over the water and inhale the steam. Try this with eucalyptus oil if you have any kind of respiratory issue, especially coming this winter. Then there's humidifiers. Just like a diffuser, cool air humidifiers are best. Now, be aware that essential oils can damage plastic over time, so choose one that's made for essential oils. That's why our oils are sold in bottles, because if you sell them in plastics, the essential oil can erode the plastic. Then there's fans or vents. Just like with the indirect inhalation, you can add the oil to a cloth and place it in a vent, like a heating vent, or in front of a fan. Try this with peppermint in the car for anyone that has motion sickness. How cool is that? You can use essential oils as a perfume or a cologne. Just add 1 drop or a small dab to your wrists behind the ears, or add 10 drops to 1 to 3 teaspoons of distilled water or alcohol to mist on your body or your clothing. So lots of ways to directly inhale essential oils. Those are all great ideas. Number 2, you could use them topically. And topically means putting it on your skin. And there's a word called neat. Just like when people drink vodka and they say, I have a vodka neat. That means with no ice or any other things that would dilute it. So you could put essential oils on your body, on your skin, neat, directly to the skin without any dilution. However, I think it's still a good idea to do a patch test on your own skin just in case. Because diluting never hurts. It doesn't decrease the effectiveness of the oils and actually may help to increase absorption by preventing evaporation, as well as decreasing the likelihood of a skin reaction. And those with sensitive skin, as well as children and the elderly, should do a patch test or dilute before use for sure. Use a guideline of 1 to 3 ratio. 1 drop of essential oil to every 3 drops of a carrier oil, such as sweet almond or coconut. And if you're pregnant or nursing, please use more caution or talk to your naturopathic doctor, and avoid this for children or pets on direct skin contact. It's usually better to layer oils than to blend them. And what this means is that if you're using 2 or more oils topically on your skin, apply one, then wait between 5 to 30 minutes and apply the other over the first, instead of mixing each drop in your hand and then rubbing it into the skin. And I gave you an example of layering for sore muscles a couple weeks ago. And if you want a repeat of that, just head over to the website, tinydropseo.com. And there's instructions as to how to layer some essential oils that will help you with any muscle or back pain. Another way to topically use essential oils is through massage. Massaging the oil in joints, muscles, and tissues is relaxing and beneficial. Or you can make hot or cold compresses. Soak a cloth or a towel in cool water with drops of your favorite essential oil and then place over the area of concern. Or wrap the cloth or towel in a hot water bottle to use as a warm compress. Oils for muscles and joints in a cool or warm compress on the muscles is amazing, believe me. Or you could use it topically for bathing and foot baths. You can add essential oils to your bath water, to your bath salts, or to your foot bath to soak in. Tea tree oil in a foot bath helps soothe itchy feet. And when using it in these ways, it's a good idea to mix with a carrier oil to help disperse the oil and protect your skin from getting multiple drops all in one time. Then some people use essential oils internally. And I'm not going to suggest that you do that, because not all essential oils can be used internally, nor should all people use them in this way. Even though the FDA has listed certain oils as generally recognized as safe for internal use, and because our oils are therapeutic grade, which means you could, I'm going to recommend that you don't do that unless you speak with your naturopathic physician or other trusted health advisor. And finally, you can use essential oils around the home. And I believe I talked about that last week. I give you lots of tips how to use make an air cleanser, a carpet cleaner, get rid of cooking odors, eliminate smoke, fabric softeners, freshen your trash can, hand cleaner, mold. So yes, you can find that again on the tinydropseo.com website under Health Solutions. So there you have it. Some more ways to use these very beneficial plant-based healing alternatives to help you with any issues that you might be having. So again, head over to tinydropseo.com. Tiny drops, big results. That's tinydropseo.com. Well, there you have it. I know we're running out of time. So I'm going to hope that you head over to the Speak Up and Stay Alive website this week to look at the EMF safety site and perhaps get a hold of some of these handheld radio frequency meters. Very, very important. Then head over to tinydropseo.com for some fun and get yourself some essential oils. Alrighty then, until next week, I hope you have a healthy and a happy week. I am Pat Rulo, the voice for patient safety, and I am your guide to safe and successful healthcare and hospital encounters.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.